no education and experience, and then we think we learn something, and then all of a sudden everything changes. Just when you thought you had it right, the kids say, oh, that's not the way I'm thinking now. Mary and I this morning would like to just chat with you on the topic of parenting adult children, and by that we mean people from the ages of about 16 to 30 is the area that we're targeting in. And we want to make this as interactive as we can. We've got an hour and, about 20 minutes. We've got 4 hours of material. Really, we won't try and do that, but we're going to try and pick some highlights out of some work that we've been doing over the last 2 years. And we've wrestled through it with about 40 other couples of our age and stage in our church. And they thought we were never going to end. It went on for week after week after week. And so we're going to try and help condense some things for you today and to give you an opportunity to share and see if we can't learn something from one another. Let's just ask the Lord to bless our time together as we get started. Father, thank you now for the privilege of having children. Thank you for the privilege we have in this age of most of them surviving to adulthood. A fact that just wasn't there in the previous century. And thank you for the privilege you've given us of being Christian parents. Help us, Lord, to be people who love Christ, who love our children, and want to help them to love you also. So we commit this day to you now in Christ's name. Amen. Mary and I are going to go back and forth on a number of things. We'll probably get our signals crossed once in a while. But we'd like you to be able to interrupt or to ask questions anywhere along the way, because it's not just us communicating to you, but it's us talking some things over. So, hon.
As you look at your handout, we're only going to be concentrating in a few places, but we've added some things that you can check at your own leisure. This is the table of contents for a book that NAB Press is going to be doing soon, and we're obviously not going to be able to cover all that material, but starting on, I guess you'd call it page 3, we'll be trying to cover this material. And then at the very end, the last two pages are a condensation of some of our thinking and some references that might be of interest to you later on. I always like to recommend that if you see books here, especially books by Christian publishers, that you find helpful, encourage your public library to put them in the shelf. And they'll almost always do it when you make a request, and then there's good material there for the next parents that come along looking. When we were young parents and with younger children, someone said to us, once a parent, always a parent. And we thought, oh no, pretty soon they're all going to be gone and we'll enjoy the grandchildren and our recreational vehicle. But we found that is not true. Once a parent, always a parent.
That's a plug. She wants an RV. I don't. I knew she'd get it in this morning.
We used to have one that was great fun. I'd like to take a poll. How many of you, parenting adult children, also have an RV? Oh, please raise your hand.
We decided it was a choice, an RV or college.
So far, we're still in like a rent one. There we
well, we
go.
Used to have one. We used to have this trailer we pulled around, and the kids loved it. I tolerated it.
But we want you to know that we are with you in process. We have made many mistakes. We feel God has given us some guidance in doing a few things right, but we're in an unfinished task, and therefore this is an unfinished seminar and will remain unfinished until the Lord either takes us or our children home to be with Him. But through this process, we want to be people who weep with parents who are weeping and people who rejoice with parents who are rejoicing. And sometimes if you have more than one child, you're doing both at the same time. And so just a little encouragement along those lines. We are right now weeping with a couple that is weeping. Their son was a bright and very happy youngster, but as he entered his teens, things began to change. And although he'd been given a very solid family spiritual background with much time from his parents and intensity into his life, he began to digress from the things that he'd been taught. And at first it was very small things. He became lax in his schoolwork, and he started cutting classes through his high school years, and he began to smoke, and he began to choose wrong companions, and then he began to stay out all night. And as we walked through this experience with the parents and this son, we grieved with them because they couldn't understand it. And all around them, they saw parents with youngsters who were doing very well, and yet that wasn't happening in their lives. And ultimately, it came to the point where he was in trouble with the law, and they said either a special school or jail. So right now, he's in his late teens, and he is spending all of his time now in a special school in California that costs his parents $1,500 a month with no help from insurance. And they're grieving and they're weeping. But they are people who trust in God, and so they're looking to him for help, and they're hoping in God for the future of this son. And that's what we want to do as well. One mother said, never has a group, speaking of us as parenting adult children, never has a group tried so hard and been blamed so much as today's parents. And so if we get our focus off what other people are saying and thinking and on to the God of hope and help, we're going to have a different focus and a different outlook.
Couple chairs up here if we want in the front, and be sure and get one of the handouts if you've come in late. We'd like to divide our thinking on parenting adult children into two periods. One is the changeable period of 16 to 22, where they're part adolescent, part adult, part teenager, and part something else which we have never been able to identify. And then it goes into this independent anxiety of the ages of 22 to 30, when all those new experiences invade their lives, a new job, finishing college, having children, being married, hopefully in the reverse order. And where are their parents during this time? Well, the parents are worrying, interfering, praying, talking, regretting what they didn't do, and wondering why Psalm 127:1, which says, train up a child in the way he shall go, and when he's old, he will not depart from it, wondering why it didn't work. And because we really have given ourselves to helping them. One of the books that we refer to and feel has been the most helpful in our research has been the book called The Postponed Generation by Susan Litwin. And in that book, The Postponed Generation, Susan Litwin relates why our children today are growing up later. And I've given that reference, by the way, in the back. That's one of the four books. We only recommended four books. Incidentally, three of them are secular in our bibliography. And she tries to deal with what is happening to the children of people today, particularly those that are in this infamous middle class. And I'd like to read just a few quotes from her to give you an idea of what she is trying to communicate that, and we feel is important. One of the things she mentions is that our children will probably not be able to have the same standard of living that many of us had, and that we need to realize, and they need to realize, that they are not, at least immediately, going to have that standard of living, but in fact, they want it, and they want it when? Now. That's exactly right. And here is what she says. They set great store by having a stylish place to live. This is not a generation of pioneers. They're just kids with a high sense of entitlement and not so high sense of reality. They believe, in measure, that they are entitled to a good life, a good place to live, a good job, and extra money so that they can take vacations. She also reports this. She said, studies by the University of Michigan's Institute for Social Research and by the Social Survey Research Team of Jan Kelevich, Skelly and White, show that young Americans now feel increasingly goalless and anxious. The crises they face is part of their special history. They were raised in the 60s, when we were all greening and changing in various ways, and best of all, knew that we could afford to do so, and believed that our children would also be able to. If we told them that life could be tough, if we never told them that life could be tough, it was because we had forgotten it ourselves. She further states, it would turn out that the expectations they grew up with weren't going to work, at least not in reality. But they lived on in a fantasy. And since the fantasies were so much nicer, it was reality that had to go. They lament that so many jobs are in the city rather than in the mountains where the air is cleaner. Or they leave entry-level jobs because the company did not implement their ideas immediately. It's hard enough to establish our adult identity, even in the best of times, she says, but to do so with such a jarring conflict between expectation and reality is a stunning task. What many of today's 20 to 30-year-olds have elected to do is to continue the identity search while avoiding reality, and that makes it very slow work. And that'll give you a little taste of some of the research that she has done, and I think it's very good. One of the problems that Mary and I have observed is that in these two major phases of adult life, the adolescent phase and this later young adult life, they have not yet learned and must learn that life is not simple. And in fact, life is very, very difficult. And in one of the other books that we referred to, M. Scott Peck's book, The Road Less Traveled, how many of you have read it? Okay, I like that first line, life is difficult. And unless you come to grips with the fact that life is difficult, you will live in fantasy. And so they need to learn that it's complex, that there are problems and hard decisions. Now, we understand this. Most of us do. I would imagine most of you live better than your parents. How many of you observe yourselves living better than your parents? Quite a few of you do. Most of you did that on your own, in a sense. You, so to speak, worked hard, and you had an ethic that made those things possible. But do we really remember some of the turmoil and trauma of our own teenage and young adult years? Most of us don't really. We've got selective memories. But let me just remind you a little bit. Remember those conflicts and those fears and those anxieties? Remember the peer pressures? Remember the guilt of giving in to temptation? Remember the discovery of your sexual self and the first loves and the first heartbreaks? Remember the struggle that you had with sin that you committed? Recall some of your feelings toward your parents and toward your brothers and sisters. In a sense, what we need to do for ourselves, because you see, we're sitting here as people who can't do something for our kids. The only thing we can do is to do something for ourselves, and then through that, maybe to help them. So remember and relive some of the anger and the hurts and the embarrassments or your loneliness, but also remember some of the times of feeling good, the times that really went well, and the reaching goals and loving and being loved in return and the first kiss and the first date. Remember the secrets you never told your parents. If you were sexually experienced before marriage, remember the inner struggles and the guilt and even the elation of the experience. And bring back the memory of all the things that resulted from that decision. Or remember some of your own experience with alcohol or perhaps drugs or your thoughts about suicide. These memories aren't very pleasant, but somehow we have to recognize that our kids are not immune from them. Now, see, one part of us desperately wants to protect our sons and daughters from that which we experienced that was bad, and then on the other part, we want to mandate on them our successes, and to force upon them the lessons that we learned by very difficult times. But this is a different age. Their world is not our world. They did not, quote, live on a farm, walk 2 miles to school in a blizzard, carry newspapers for $1 a week, or experience whatever fantasy you may have of your young years. And it doesn't do any good to tell them. And we have to remember that conflict, both internal and external, is normal. And that arguments and misunderstandings take place in the family. And by the way, if they can't get mad and can't have conflict inside the family, where can they? I mean, where can they do it with so little cost for themselves, at least? So put yourself in their place and feel their pain. Now, just in case some of you in here have had kids that have just grown up, they've been totally cooperative, they've not gone across a bump, and they have never experienced some of these negative traits, let me just encourage you that they do have that turmoil, and it will come out sometime in their adult life. And so we would just like to encourage you. So what can you do? How can you prepare? Well, first, you can look at your own experience. Second, you can look at your parents. You can learn from others, and you can admit your own need to change and grow. Even if they don't change, you and I can. And then we can develop a few very basic principles, and that's what we'd like to help you to develop today.
Wouldn't it be easy if on page 110 in the scripture the Lord said, now at age 16, here's what you can do with your son. At age 25, here's how you can relate to your daughter. But it doesn't work like that. And we have to draw principles from the scripture that we can use in these intervening, in these changing years to make these relationships with our sons and daughters the best that they can be. All scriptural teaching on relationships applies to our sons and daughters. And then there are some extra things that the scripture does tell us. For example, if we're reading 1 Corinthians 13 about love, and we come to verses 4 to 7, we see some ways in which we can apply specific things to our children. Living says love is very patient and kind, never boastful or proud, never haughty or selfish or rude, and it goes on, and we see a lot of things that we can do in our relationship with our youngsters, the way we can apply things. And I think it's very helpful, especially if we're going through struggles with our young adults, to look in the Word for specific instruction on relationships and to follow those. For example, in Ephesians 4:25, we're told to speak the truth in love. I think it's easy for parents to sometimes avoid saying anything for fear of further conflict or rejection or whatever it might be. Speak the truth in love. What's edifying? What's helpful? That we can speak. And Ephesians 4 also tells us to be forgiving, loving, kind, tender-hearted. And sometimes in our homes, the opposite is seen. Are we spiritually encouraging? Do we have that mutual encouragement? Sometimes our youngsters come to us with a rebuke. Can we receive that in the tone that it can be spiritually encouraging? At Christmas, all of our children were home. Three are married, one grandchild at this point. Everyone was there. And one evening, one said, let's have a family time. And, oh, that sounded great. And we had some excess people, as we always seem to have at Christmas. And so we took the family into our bedroom. And as we reviewed later, it seemed to us it was sort of bash mom and dad time. Well, were we willing to accept that in the spirit in which the Lord would have us accept it? And we thought later, we got a little defensive with each other. Fortunately, we were able to restrain ourselves and not try to defend ourselves to the children. And they really had some valid points. But later on, we said, well, you know, we're not as bad as it sounded, did we? But are we willing to accept this exchange and no longer to be the only ones who are presenting the correct way to live, the correct way to follow God, and so on? So as we're looking through the scripture, let's be careful to follow all of those instructions that the Lord gives us on relationships. But there are some specific ones for families. Number one, they are to honor us as we are to honor our parents. Exodus 12:20. This is the first commandment with a promise. So honor your father and mother. Do they see that in our example? Maybe our parents are gone, but in our remembrances of them, do they hear us honoring their parents so that they have a model to follow with us? Do we make it as easy as possible for them to honor us? It's not easy to honor an obnoxious person. Well, are we obnoxious with our young adults? And so that is a specific instruction that needs to be applied in the family situation. And then also, parents do not exasperate. Some translations would say parents, but some would say fathers. Do not exasperate your children. We know a 40-year-old man who is still waiting for some commendation from his father. Never an I love you, never you're doing a good job. Still waiting. Okay, how you can honor your own parents, not asking, because this is a command to an individual. And so you can't say to your youngsters, you will honor me, but you can honor your own parents. Jerry, you may want to comment on this. I heard Lila Trotman speak one time, a few of you know who she is, and she said, if you can't honor your parents for anything else, you can honor them because God chose them to give you life. Minimizing verbal criticism in front of other people. Trusting God that He will at some point bring a change in their lives, and until He does, that He will change our attitude. Very helpful to pray daily for our parents.
We've lost our parents, so we've lost that opportunity.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I think then it's helpful to be very careful that we don't dishonor them in front of other people or especially in front of our children. They're picking up signals on how they will treat us when we are older. Okay.
Susie came to China with me. So as we talked about that, we said, that's something that we want to avoid in our relationship to you. And obviously that's tearing down. The actual situation is tearing down. Help me to understand how I can honor that. And you suggested that they chose to have Susan. There's another option to give me either.
Are you talking about how you can speak to your own children about Susie's parents? There's no excuse you can give for an abusive parent. Did they know the Lord?
Yeah.
Hard to know.
Do your children know about the abuse? Okay.
I think only, well, probably not to talk about it too much.
Yeah.
But to also suggest that they were not following the Lord. If they had had an experience with the Lord, this would not have happened in their lives. Somehow they missed that opportunity or did not make that decision.
I think this is really a tough area today because there are many, many of us in our generation who have been abused by parents, either sexually or emotionally or physically in some way. And we recently listened to some tapes and some things on that dealt with this area. But one of the things that we have to recognize is that leaves marks on our lives. And the one thing that you can do is to try to understand the marks that it has left upon you. And in that regard, realize that some of the tension that comes between you and your kids is a result of an overreaction to the circumstances that you may have been in. And thus the roles that you took as a child in your own home, it projects into the home that you then lead, usually trying to correct. What the unfortunate thing is without Christ is often we repeat the same attitudes, if not the same acts, because we are children of our parents. And it's very hard not to do that. And it may be that some other things will come up as we go on through our time that might give some help as we guide our kids in these things.
I think that's very key. Christ is changing patterns in our lives. He is breaking those old ones. We're looking toward the future with hope. And it may be that with your generation, old patterns will stop. New patterns will begin.
Yes.
We had a friend that said that his father and he used to have physical fights. And he said that if things were allowed to go on, that he and his children would repeat the same thing. But he said, if you can pray to God and God will change your actual makeup.
Right.
Change the genetics so that this won't be passed on to the next generation.
Well, it's both genetic and it's environmental. We become very much like our parents were, as much as we may have hated things that were in our parents. Yes, Ford?
Don't you think that forgiving our parents, we were short,
yeah,
one way to break the emotional umbilical cord and not repeat the same cycle, not having root bitterness?
Right. And, of course, when they've already gone, it's a very difficult thing.
Even
then, we can forgive them in our hearts. And I think that's very important to grant them forgiveness. We have known an adult child who has had, through into the 40s, has just had constant struggles with the parents and an unwillingness to forgive them. And others who have had to go to their parents when they were 40, 50, and say, I forgive you. And they say, for what? Well, it's hard to say, for what? And you may not even want to get into it, but there sometimes need to be that actual forgiving, and that's very good for
you. And that may be a process as well as an event in time.
Mm-hmm.
It may be that the Lord would need to take a person through a process of forgiveness.
That's right. Should I go ahead?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, should I just finish up? Just this matter of exasperating. If we can see, as we're relating to our adult children, that they're frustrated, they're tense, they're not communicating, might be that we're doing something in an exasperating way. And if in our families we haven't had really open conversation, really open communication in the past, it's never too late to start. We're finding that out as we go along, that communication can open and open and open, and we can learn a lot as well as enjoy a more free conversation with our adult children.
In this little incident that Mary mentioned that happened a week ago today, I think it was, or somewhere about that, it was really quite open, but it wasn't, you know, there was a little tenseness in it, but they felt the freedom to share what they were thinking. And one of the incidents was that I had apparently been relatively short on the telephone with one of my daughters, just sort of, not abrupt, but kind of, she thought I was doing something else, and I probably was. And it happened two or three times. So we had this discussion. And I asked later, we went out with one of the couples, one of our daughter and son-in-law, and says, what'd you think of that time? And the son-in-law said, I've never been in quite that open a conversation. Well, we're just learning on that. That wasn't happening, I'd say, a few years ago in our lives. We'd like to share with you a goal. Were you through with, did you have something
I'm
else?
I'm just going to stand here.
You're going to stand here and look at me?
Guarding my time.
Oh, okay. She's going to make sure that I quit at the right time. This is in your handout, but we would like to propose a goal for adult children. Our overall goal for our sons and daughters is that they grow into mature, independent, godly adults, and with these characteristics, who base their lives on sound principles, who are emotionally and spiritually strong, who have a strong sense of responsibility toward their fellow man, who will face good and difficult times with calmness and perseverance, and who, if married, become competent and faithful husbands, wives, and parents. Now, see, we can't force any of that, but there are things that we can do to help them develop. Even if we blew it totally in time past, there are things that we can do now to help them. Now, what do we do to do this? I don't know how this thing turns off. There it goes. I'd like to take you to the book of Luke for just a minute. If you have your Bible, you can turn to it. This is a very familiar passage. And I'm not going to spend much time on it, but it's Luke chapter 15. This is the passage on the prodigal son. And I'd like to simply point out some key things that that father did right. And by the way, have you ever noticed how the responsibility usually goes back on the father? Now think of the implications of the single-parent homes in this day and age. I mean, it is mind-boggling. Okay, in verse 12 of Luke chapter 15, says the younger of these two sons said to them, "Father, give me the share of the estate that falls to me." And the father divided his wealth between them. So first of all, observe, the younger demanded his independence. The father granted it, and he treated them equally. Just three observations. Then in verse 13, he says, "Many days later, the younger son gathered everything together and went on a journey into a distant country, and he squandered his estate with loose living." So the younger person squandered, spent it all, lived a loose life, and he chose his own way. And folks, they will. And they must. They choose their own way. We have friends right now trying to prevent a divorce amongst their children. We've got other friends whose kids have been divorced. I could go through story after story. When Mary and I started about a year and a half ago, just mentioning we were doing this study, it was as though we threw a firecracker into the midst of things, and people would come and ask for the manuscript before we even had it written. And they were desperate for what was going on. Their children had gone and squandered everything on drugs. Recently, we had a little meeting. One of our staff convened it for just staff of who have children who are having very difficult times, whether it be drugs or marriage issues or whatever. And it was really, I understand, a tremendously refreshing time, a helpful time. Then verses 14 and 15 share that when he'd spent everything, a famine came, and he began to be in need, and he went and attached himself to one of the citizens of that country, and he sent him into the fields to feed swine. So you see, he lived with what? Reality and the consequences of his decision. Nobody rescued him. He was out there and did it. Then in verse 17 through 19, where he said he came to his senses and then reflected on what he had. So he again made a decision, and the decision was to go back. Now you tell me what a tough decision is. That is a tough decision, because he would have to go back and say, "Dad, I was wrong." Then in verse 20, he says, he thought in his mind, "I'm going to say, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven and in your sight. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me as one of your hired men.' So he got up and came to his father, and while he was still a long way off, his father saw him." I wonder how many times that father went out, sat, and just wept, and looked into the distance to see if maybe, I wonder how many times he saw someone coming and wondered if it was his son. How many times have you heard the telephone ring and wondered if it was, and so forth. See, he sat like that. And then, while he was a long way off, he said he saw him and felt compassion and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And then he gave his speech. "Father, I have sinned against you. I have sinned against whatever it was." You know, I don't know how he did it, but I'm sure it was not easy at all. And the father welcomed him, hugged him, gave him clothes, and he had no idea when he did that whether or not he had repented. Did you notice that? He didn't know. And then he said he'd repented. The son confessed. The father allowed the confession to take place. He didn't say, "Okay, that's no problem at all." He allowed the confession to take place, and the son had to realize his own personal folly. Then in verses 22 and 24, I won't read that all, but the father not only forgave, but gave him the best robe and his ring and a pair of sandals. And it says the father rejoiced. Then we come to the other son, the good son. And often there are those kinds. We have both. And that good son was ticked off. He was jealous and angry against the father and the older son. And the older son now tried to show his own independence and tried to come in. And the father entreated him and said, listen, everything I have is yours. I gave you equally. But now you've got to rejoice because the son who was gone has now returned. And so, through the whole process, the father still entreats and loves both of them equally. And the obedient son is still more blessed. A few observations. One is love them regardless of their actions. There should be nothing that can happen that would foul up your love for your children. Second is you need to grant them independence. You may need even to tell them you are independent. Grant them, guard against favoritism, but yet practice justice and mercy. Let them live with their decisions, but still plead and reason with them, and then let God work through the circumstances. And so these are just some thoughts that we have had in terms of helping them. Now, we'd like to share a few things with you now on just how to prepare them for leaving.
The first preparation is that our mindset needs to change. We have had lots of control and influence up to this point, and yet there needs to come that point where we take our hands off and allow them to go. Jerry and I discovered this little idea some time ago, and it's the way many of us feel oftentimes. But Mom, I've been grounded for 32 years. And sometimes when we see our young people doing things that don't make sense, we'd like to ground them for another 10, 15, 20 years. And it's very difficult to release in our minds. I think if we start preparing, many of us don't have this chance anymore, but from the time they're infants, we're told we're working ourselves out of a job. We read that in child-rearing books, but we don't really believe it. But it's true. We are working ourselves out of that very active parenting role. But it's hard to keep that in mind. Irma Bombeck can often put her finger right on things in such a clear way, and I think she did that with this particular topic. She said, if it's true that life begins when the kids are grown and the dog dies, then why do we have all that wisdom left over when they go? You'd think at the end of 20 years of child raising, we'd come out even, but we don't. I've seen mothers fight to keep from running down the aisle at their son or daughter's wedding, screaming, wait, I'm not finished with you yet. And parents are upset because they've gone from being a supervisor of a child's life to being a spectator. It's sort of like being vice president of the United States. There's so much we want to tell them. We want to let them know that the number of checks in a checkbook doesn't necessarily coincide with the amount of money in their checking account. And we want to let them know that federal taxes aren't an option like joining a fitness club. The empty nest hits hard. Once we were the center stage in their lives, and now we look out, and the audience left the theater, and they didn't even turn out the lights. Well, that's the way we feel sometimes, isn't it, when our youngsters grow up and leave. We aren't ready for it in our minds. We see the possibilities of all kinds of tragedy and danger, and we keep running along behind, clinging, instead of releasing and letting them go. And sometimes there are valid reasons for that. We've seen them make very poor decisions through their teen years, and we think, well, this can only continue. We really fear for them. We're turning them loose in a different world than the one in which we grew up. And we fear for their futures. And sometimes we want to live vicariously through them, to keep them close to us and to take on ourselves their own successes and victories. And sometimes we just lack trust in them and in God, and so we're unwilling to release them and to let go. A very necessary thing as we're releasing our children, letting them go, is to be solidly together as a couple, if you are a couple, to pray together for ourselves and for our children, for wisdom that can only come from God, and to support and encourage one another when we're having difficult times. It's so easy to look at ourselves and say, if we had done this, things would be different. And we need to support and encourage one another through that, to rejoice with one another, and never, never to assess blame. That's only God's business.
What do you mean, assess blame?
To
do you
say
mean blame your
to you, if you had done, if you were doing, now do, to say things would be different. That is only God's business, to convict us of what should have been done in the past, to go before him for forgiveness, but not to challenge each other as
okay, so that's not to blame each other for whether we were there or weren't there.
Right.
Okay.
Or anyone else that may have influenced their lives. Not to assess blame and not to take credit. Both belong in God's court. If our children are doing well, let's give God the glory. A few weeks ago, I was sharing with a friend who lives in another state about a difficult situation one of our daughters was going through. And it was very hard to share it because I took personal blame on myself, as I shouldn't have done, for this situation. And we finished and we talked it over. And then just a short time later in the conversation, she said to me, well, as I look at our parenting, it seems to me we did things right. And that is not a helpful thing to other parents who are going through struggles. So let's give God the credit and let's allow him to do the convicting, not one another.
Jim?
The impression I get as I listen to this discussion about letting go is, if you were going to graph it, if it's as if you have total control up to some single point, and then all of a sudden you don't have any control.
Right.
And our experience in letting go is that it's much more a gradual thing.
Right.
Right. Maybe we ought to go into this chart right now. Here is how we view some of this. I'm sorry this isn't in your notes, but basically, in the early years, you predominate with control. But there's little coaching, and there's some counsel, and there's a lot of caring. Now, control is where you tell them what to do. Whereas coaching is like the coach sitting on the sideline. You send in the plays, but frankly, they play the game. See, so you're coaching, but you can't do it for them. Counsel is when they come and ask you, and you just give them some suggestions. And of course, caring is the thing that goes on. But Jim, you're exactly right. It's all messed up in there, isn't it? It's not messed
it's
up. That's not the right way, but it's all mixed.
It's a sequential.
Right. The one thing that we find that almost has to die completely is control.
We're kidding ourselves if we think we're controlling.
Right.
That's right.
Now, I don't know whether we tried to be imprecise here, but the one that's hard to stop doing is coaching, sending in the plays. Do you have any more thoughts on that, hon?
That's fine.
Why don't you go ahead and...
That's your show.
Yeah. We've found an active role in this. And we've come from a passive child, but they decide everything.
Yes, that you become passive? That's right.
Right.
Isn't that terrible? You just want to so badly grab them by the scruff of the neck and shake them and say, wake up, wake up. you can.
If control terminates at the age level, you suggested, what do you do with your college years when, in fact, you're financing your education? You do have some to learn responsibility and accountability.
Go ahead.
Control doesn't phase out anymore.
Yeah, we have.
We've
this has been a major
about
point
a
of
lot.
This is a major point of conflict, and what we have we've talked over the control issue with them and said, you know, this is the ultimate form of control. I control the purse strings. You know, you want to go off and play on the beach and have a good time and enjoy the social life, and I pay the, and want me to pay the bills, and I we've said it that bluntly at times, but we have to negotiate with them on what their responsibility is. With one of our children, we finally just had to pull all the funds and just say, hey, you're doing it on your own. And with others, we've done different things. Each child is different. And we don't want to do it maliciously or use it as a point of intimidation. But yet they do have an agreement with us. I have found this is one of the major points of conflict between me, Dad, and my kids. Mary doesn't get into it as much because she'll always say, well, let's check with Dad. Or I'll say,
I'm
ask Mother.
I'm starting to back off on that and
yeah, we're
take
learning
a lot of
this.
The responsibility because in the financial areas we are mutually agreeing. And you do get pressure because through all of ours we've heard of the generosity of other parents of college students as compared with the non-generosity of our approach. And so, it's hard. You have to stand together.
Right. Yes, Bruce?
One thing we found has been helpful is that to help them sort of bite the bullet on the responsibility thing. We try to help out on the tuition and sort of work all the discretionary money they have for themselves.
Right.
If they want to go to the beach, or the spring break, fine, go ahead. But you're responsible for the money for it.
Right.
And then, you know, that doesn't back.
Right.
Right.
We have basically followed that, and some can't. Like my parents and Mary's parents could pay nothing. How many of your parents paid for your college? Can I see your hand? Okay, a few of you did have it. We did not happen to have that.
But they don't appreciate hearing
they
the
don't
struggle
want to hear that.
We had. And it really isn't relevant either.
It isn't relevant because it says you've got it. You know, you go buy a new television. Why can't you buy so forth?
Jerry, one of the things that we found really helped in raising our kids was the issue of finances.
Right.
And when they were 12 years old, we made them have a checking account. And we put their tuition or their allowance in it. And it was fairly meager.
Mm-hmm.
But then beyond that, we put into it what we thought were the expenses of necessity. Shampoo and underwear and things like that.
Right.
And a little discretionary money. And then we did the same thing through college. We put their tuition money in their account, and they had to pay their bills. And we found that was very helpful.
Yeah, and I think that's the best way to do it. I think what he is describing. We had one of our children who was always a hassle, and so the financial thing in high school, and so we did that. We gave them X amount, and they had to manage it. And so
they didn't get another monthly dole.
Yeah. Go ahead and then.
I put my daughter through 3 years of college, and she decided that it was more important for her in the summer to go over with the group, singing group, and spend her time for 3 months around the United States than it was to help me make some money for her support in college.
Did you stick with it?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
And I talked to her about it since for 8:34 and all, but she said that was a very intelligent decision.
In retrospect, they will appreciate those things of the hard decisions that were made. Yes, that's good.
Our first is a boy, and this seemed to be easier for me in the letting go because I had more confidence in him being on the highway at night by himself just around the city, but I'm fine now. So much more protective of her in the areas. I mean, it's just the fashion. It's not that she's not any brighter or anything like that. It's just her own physical protection. I'm feeling that that's really a hard thing for me to deal with.
Yeah, Mary struggled with that.
Our oldest is a son, and then we have three daughters. And I have felt very strongly about this, too. You can get books from the library, information from the police department, different places, women's groups and so on just specific things to teach your daughters about their own safety. You never get in a car without your doors locked. You carry a little thing, call police, and all this, you know, little things like that that can give you some sense that they have as much security as you can provide. But there comes a point when you have to say, Lord, they're in your care and protection. Surround them, keep them in your protective hand, and you have to let them go. Because the tighter you hold and the more you keep describing the dangerous situations that are out there, and believe me, there are lots, the more resentful they become. But if we can just be logical and clear with them that, you know, you do lock the doors and you do take these precautions, and then we trust God.
And I think there's always going to be a little tension between mom and dad. My tendency is to push them out, say, well, you've got to live with it. And I can go to sleep at night and Mary can't on those kinds of situations. But that's part of the thing we have to struggle with, and that's the balance of giving them independence. And do you have anything else you want to share on this now?
No.
What is your definition of coaching and counseling? What is counseling and coaching?
It's when the coaching has a directiveness to it that I think you ought to do this. And whereas the counsel is more in a responsive mode. Answering questions and giving many options, whereas coaching tends to be giving about one option, yet they must choose it. And I feel coaching is more directive than counseling. Now, we've chosen these words to just help us describe the concept of a process of them growing to independence. So, Buck?
In the counseling, is this only solicited by the child, or is this something that the parent can offer unsolicited?
I'd say either, but in general it's going to be unsolicited. It's going to be solicited.
The more it would be solicited.
Yeah. The older that young adult becomes, as they start approaching that 20 area, there would be very little in the way of unsolicited counsel. Now, if you see danger, we have a little guideline. When we see danger, I mean real danger, either in a relationship or in something, yes, we'll go in unsolicited. And we take the risks and take the knocks on it. Or obvious sin.
And that would be a responsibility whether they were our children or not, just if they were brother or sister in Christ.
Right. Well, we take risk, and by the way, in doing that, you make mistakes. At least I do. Sometimes I get the kids angry. And it's particularly pertinent when they're single. Something happens after they get married that it's almost as though a switch is turned in our heads and we stop interfering, although they may need it as much.
There is the scriptural teaching that a man leaves his father and mother.
Right.
And so once our children are married, if we keep barging in, we are not helping them nor to obey Scripture, nor doing it ourselves.
That's right. Do you want to do this, or should we?
Yeah. Carry on.
Okay. We want to talk a little bit about the... Yes, Ford?
Yes, I do. I would cite Titus 2, 4, and 5, you know, where we're to love our husbands and love our children. It doesn't say hang on to mom. It says, you know, listen to the older women. But mm-hmm. leaving, however, when you see it...
We, I think, would say they both must leave. The main thing is she needs to come under the authority of that husband, not under the authority of her parents. Now, here's a little observation we have made, both with our kids and with most other couples. Normally, the social flow will go toward the wife's family.
Would most of you have observed that to be true?
Yeah,
You're going to spend a lot of time together, or somebody is initiating getting together as the extended family, it will most often be with the wife's family.
And the son will feel more comfortable in his wife's family than the wife will feel comfortable in the son's family. Now, that there are
now,
many exceptions.
Now, that's a gross generalization,
yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. There are exceptions.
And I think as a mother, I'm a very dominating woman, and I don't think I'm going to be able to tell my boys. I think it'll be a constant battle. You know, with the family.
Are any of them married yet?
No, my oldest one's leaving home.
Okay.
And I know myself, that's what I'm trying to handle that.
Could be tough, but it may not also be true. It depends on how much acceptance and how much approval they feel. Penny? It can happen, but we just note the trend. That's the main thing you need to see, and not fight it. Now, we aren't going to have time in this session to go into the in-law relationships. They get very complicated. But what we'd like to do now is talk a little bit about moving to independence. Just to show you this, we'll just show you this. We don't have it in our plan, but here's what happens as you start having the in-laws. I mean, just think of how the complications of your... And we haven't drawn all the lines that are there. We've only drawn part of them.
And so it's a fallacy to think as our family grows and leaves home, things will become less complicated. You can see it becomes more complicated with relationships.
Yeah, and you think you'd be free and you aren't. But now we want to talk a little about independence, and we're going to shorten this little section. We'll try to, because we want to get on to the last part, because it has to do with facing some difficult times and a couple things on decision-making. But first of all, there are two areas we'd like to cover. We cover much more in this book that we've done, but it is spiritual independence and communications. We feel those are the two key areas. Let me make only a few comments on spiritual independence. These kids are thinking for themselves. They're thinking questions like, does God exist? Is the Bible true? Is Jesus really the only way? Do you really believe all of the Bible? Now, those kinds of questions become suppressed in our homes because they know how most of us feel. But they are going to come out. So what is going to happen with kids is the first thing they're going to do is they'll recognize an issue. They'll actually frame it in their mind. Then there will often come a period of rejection, then a period of reevaluation, and then a rekindling or alteration or ultimate rejection of your values and your beliefs. Now see, the key is that they must make whatever they do, it's got to be their own. And we'd like to just share a couple things on what we feel to be the keys for spiritual independence. And this, of course, could take a great deal of time, and we're giving you some highlights of this. One thing is the belief must be truly their own. The second thing is we want to encourage them, whatever they do, is to look to the Word for it. Look to the Scriptures. They may not, and they may reject it. We must allow them to search for themselves. And the one thing we can build in, I believe, is a daily time with God. If I had any one thing I would like to build in, it's get time reading the Scriptures daily. Encourage them to get fellowship with others, because once they reach age 16, you have ceased to be the primary influence in their lives. And it will be peers who will influence them more than anything else. And then just pray like crazy for guidance. Now, as we go through this process, we want them to look for... I'll put this little slide up, and you're going to become upset with me because I'm going too fast here. But we want them to develop roots, not ruts. We don't want them to do things out of habit, but we want real roots. We want them to have significant other people in their lives. We have found that in each of our kids' lives, there's usually been one other person that's had a major influence in their formative years. We must avoid stifling legalism, and we need to learn to discuss issues. We need to somehow figure out how you can discuss issues without arguments ensuing. Now, one other area that we're not going to discuss that I want to mention to you, you can have physical dependence and not have emotional independence. Physical independence and not have emotional independence. But we must work with them on this process. No matter how much it hurts, folks, they've got to be independent spiritually. And it hurts us in the process.
Just to touch very briefly in the area of communication, and of course there's been so much written in this and talked about over the years, but I think if we were to share anything on communication, it would be James 1:19, where James said, "My dear brothers, take note of this. Everyone should be quick to listen, slow to become." Okay, isn't that great as we deal with our growing adults? We need to take them seriously. They need to believe that we hear what they say, even when we can't agree. To tell them, well, if I understand what you're saying, here is what it is. And to repeat it back to them. To listen. Oftentimes, we know what they're going to say long before they, even when they get that look on their face.
And they know what we're going to say.
And so to move into a mode where they understand that we really want to take them seriously. And even though they are independent people and we want to have a good relationship, we need to anticipate disagreements. We have one child who has taken quite a diametrically opposed political stance to how we feel. And when we get together with that child, and I say child, he's a man, but when we get together, once in a while this will come up, but fortunately it's not the kind of thing that resolves into a personal attack. But we were together about a week ago, and we were discussing a political issue, and he said directly to Jerry, "You just don't understand. You do not see things that I see." And we live in a subdivision that's not too far from the Glen here, and he said, "You live with the clones." And I suppose he's right. You know, most people who live in our area think and act in one way. And he lives close to the downtown area where it's a real mix of people. young singles, elderly people, young families, married, several different varieties of financial status. And he said, I see things you don't see. And we stopped and thought, he's probably right.
That's right.
However, I don't think he's convincing us of his political stand. But there will be disagreements. Some will be very deep and serious and that can cause lifetime hurts. And so we need to be ready to forgive and to just avoid some of those. To be very cautious in offering advice. The coaching and the counsel really must diminish, as we've already talked, and to really avoid ridicule or criticism, because it's both unbiblical and unkind and unproductive for our relationship. But there is the matter that we need to refuse verbal abuse from them. Sometimes in the tension that young people go through as they're growing, they can become very verbally abusive. And the illustration I used of the young man at the beginning of our session resolved itself in this way. He became so verbally abusive to his parents and his sister that he simply could not remain in the home. And he became a physical threat as well. We don't have to take that. It's not biblical to allow another person to treat us in that fashion. So we don't have to receive that kind of treatment as parents or as people either. And very crucial to protect their confidences. They don't want to hear from one of our friends, oh, hey, I hear you're having a really tough time. I'm really praying for you these days. They don't need to hear that. And if they are struggling, if they have some happy secret and they've asked it not to be shared, let's guard that confidence and let's be true to that relationship with them.
Now, one of the areas, yes, Buck, you want to?
Is there sort of a fine line between the comments that you made that they have to be able to express their opinions and argue and possibly get mad at home, a fine line between that and verbal abuse?
Right.
And our need to endure and to. And to forgive, I mean, it seems like that would
right.
be a close call.
It is. And all of us with our loved ones, with our spouses, with our children, need to be able to share how we're feeling, the things that are going on in our lives, and then get those things into a biblical perspective. We all know when we have conflict, we're probably angry, and we need to. That can come out into the open, but there is a way to handle that. But if our youngsters are saying you blankety blank, you know, cursing, swearing, we don't have to accept that.
Yeah, that's right. Also, you might notice that we're not using too many specific illustrations of our kids. We've given them the manuscript. We've had to get their approval on things, and we're very, you know, they have to live their own lives, particularly when it's being recorded. On the other hand, with one of our children that's going through some heavy things right now, we have gotten specific permission in certain groups. In fact, we have actually interviewed her with our Sunday school class for 2 solid weeks on an issue that we're going through, and it was interesting, to say the least. And so we're a little careful on that. We want to be open, but we want to protect them also. Now, one of the greatest frustrations for me in the way I think is when children make decisions that don't make sense. You ever have that problem? And it may be that decision-making is one of the hardest things to teach. So I'd like to just touch for a minute or two on what you do to help them learn to make decisions. The first question you have to ask is, how did they learn to make decisions? Well, you'd be surprised. One of the key issues is they watch you. Should be let me just look at that, Buck. Thank you. Yeah, on the notes, are we going to skip?
You're going to skip this part.
I'm going to skip decision making. Is that what we decided?
You said we didn't have time.
Okay, we're not going to skip decision making. We went over this last night or night before, whatever it was. Anyhow, let me just mention a couple things. I had totally blown that, and when I told this when we made up the handout yesterday, we would not put that in. Let me just mention briefly then the parents' examples, their personality, and their intellectual ability. They each are independent as personalities, and they do have a certain intellectual capacity. Styles of thinking, and you're going to do this now, dear, since we're into it. Spiritual vitality, how spiritual they are, their education and their training, and their peer influence. And I just asterisk those that we can influence. We can influence the parents, our example, their spiritual vitality, their education. But most others we can't. Hon, why don't you just share on this very briefly.
One point of
yes, we'll keep it like that. How's that?
One point of real frustration for many families until we come to an understanding is that we think differently. Do you think differently than your spouse? Of course you do. That's why you come to certain areas of conflict. And our children do the same thing. Now, we can influence the way in which they think to a certain degree, but still their mind works in a certain way. For example, Jerry thinks analytically. That means he can take information from many different sources, put it all together, and come out with a decision. That's an analytical thinker. Then there are intuitive thinkers. Ooh, I just feel like I ought to do this. And they just seem to intuitively have an understanding. Very frustrating for an analytical thinker to try to come to grips with an intuitive thinker and vice versa. Creative. They just have 100 wild ideas for one valid one that can be put into practice. Doesn't discourage them that all these others kind of flow by the board, but their minds are always coming up.
Doesn't matter if it makes sense either.
A logical thinker. This is different from analytical in that a logical thinker needs to go step to step to step, and at step 10 it makes sense. And they cannot leap think. And so that's a different kind. You may have a logical thinker, and sometimes it's frustrating. You think they'll never come to a decision. Well, they're working their way there. Or a visionary thinker, wild ideas, big ideas. And there are others or combinations thereof. So when our youngsters are making decisions, if we can have some grasp on the way their mind works, it helps.
Now, we'd like to say what the goal is in decision-making, and I'll put this up again later so because I'm going to cover it fast. One is the first goal in decision-making is help them learn to predict and understand future consequences of present decisions. That is a major mark of maturity. There are people in their 40s and 50s who have not yet learned to do this. And the second thing is to learn to sacrifice present pleasure for future fulfillment. Those two things are very, very important in this whole process. Now, as people move into true adulthood, we've got a little thing that we call yo-yo children.
And before we talk about yo-yo children, let me just mention that we also feel that we are part of what we call a squeezed generation. And I haven't seen anything in the Christian community on this, but secular publishers are beginning to touch on this, where we are feeling pressure from our growing adults, young adults, and pressure to care for parents who are infirm and aged or difficult in some way. There are lots of pressures on this generation. It's not free like we might think. But speaking of yo-yo children, just when you think that the house is quiet and orderly, things have reached a very peaceful stage, they appear on the doorstep. And this may have happened to you. Statistics put out by the U.S. government say that 53% of the people between 18 and 24 are living at home or financially dependent on their parents, and 11% of the people between 25 and 34 are still living at home. So if you have 10 kids, one of them is going to hang around a long time. And I think we need to be prepared because this is what is called the boomerang generation. They come back home. And there are a number of reasons for it. Part of it is the sexual revolution, and they just marry a lot later in life than we did. Or they have, or there's the rise in the divorce rate, and they're coming back home with one or two children. Or they can't make it financially on their own, and so they come home. And they like the designer lifestyle. They like to live like mom and dad live. And so why not move in and just have the best of both worlds? And then there are a lot of tragic cases where there's alcohol or emotional or drug abuse, and they come home just to find a place of refuge. And some of these returns can be very brief and enjoyable. We've had those, and we've had some of longer duration. Some can, as I've mentioned, be because of tragic circumstances. And it's well to clarify the situation before they move back in on finances, on the use of the home, on their particular contribution, on the amount of privacy that everyone is going to need in the home. Very important to clarify what the needs of the younger siblings are. They come first before the need of the returning one. And I think we see their younger siblings. The younger children in the family need to have, they need their turn as the older one did. And so as the older one returns, or older ones, they need to understand that these younger siblings will get the major portion of our attention and time.
We had to clarify that with one that moved back home, when we had one that was 6 years younger than she, that we will govern our family primarily around that younger one, not around her needs, and she will need to fit back in. This was after she'd finished college and so forth.
There's an interesting story in the scripture of a returning yo-yo. Samson chose a Philistine woman, forced his parents or insisted that his parents go and get him a pagan wife. And as you remember the story, there was this riddle that he presented to the villagers. He had this wager with them. And she pried the answer out of him and gave it to the villagers. And so he had to pay off his wager. And the scripture says, burning with anger, he returned home. And how would you like to have a youngster like that show up again?
Very strong, too.
Very strong.
In many ways.
He wouldn't care to argue much. In fact, you wonder, as you read the scripture, why didn't his parents give him a hard time about this woman that he'd chosen? And then you think, well, let's see, if he were a big hulk like that coming in, you might not choose to argue either. But that's the way some of these youngsters return, burning with anger or defeated in spirit. And we need to have the heart to open ourselves and to minister to them again in a new way.
I'd like to take the last little segment. We'll run a few minutes over here. Is what do you do when you face difficult times? A recent newspaper article here in Colorado Springs talked about a mother who lived through a horrifying experience. Her 29-year-old son had been missing for several years. His former roommate was charged with murder based on the discovery of the son's bloody clothes and car. And as that mother was waiting the results of this trial and this situation, she told the press, "I've never been through anything so awful in my life. I feel like I'm smothering in my own nerves." A parent who has never smothered in their own nerves can consider themselves very fortunate. But most parents of maturing adults live through some periods of apprehension and of paralyzing fear, or perhaps deep sorrow about the path that their children have chosen, or perhaps embarrassment about what they're doing. One parent said, "It's much harder to trust God for my children than for myself." There are many passages of scriptures on that. A wise son brings joy to his father, but a foolish son is grief to his mother, Proverbs 10:1. Proverbs 17:21, "To have a fool for a son brings grief. There is no joy for the father of a fool." And then Proverbs 23:24, "The father of a righteous man has great joy, and he who has a wise son delights in him. May your father and mother be glad. May she who gave you birth rejoice." But you see, whether we want to live vicariously or not, we do. Now, we may live vicariously in that we hurt vicariously for them. Now, I'd like to define this business of difficult times into two kinds of things. One is decisions that they make for themselves. That is, hard times that they bring upon themselves. And I don't have an overhead for this, so you'll have to jot these down. You see, they are making decisions on their own. For instance, what are some decisions that they make for themselves? Divorce, pregnancy, abortion, drugs, crime, suicide, running away, homosexuality, promiscuity. And now there are some of those that are like that divorce. It may not be their fault, but folks, basically, they have made choices in their lives that bring these in. So what do you do as a parent? Several suggestions. One is to realize that no matter what you do, they must live with the consequences, as much as it hurts. Secondly, we have to wait with patience, often with that silent cry in our own hearts, and you may need to wait until you see the anguish of their own heart and you can move in to help them. And it may be years, but you can't always rescue them. You can receive them, you can love them, and you can help to restore them. I think in this period, it's likely that your communication is very strained with them. And take every opportunity to communicate. Birthdays, Christmas, Thanksgiving, anniversary, whatever it is, take every opportunity to communicate whether you receive anything or not. And pray, but pray especially for a third party, another person to enter into their lives. Because it's more likely that someone else will get their attention than you. But you be there to give them the refuge that they need. The second area is problems. Yes. Or whatever. Come back home. It may be some financial things at times. Now you're going to have to make judgments on that. There may be just the love, the sense that you will not forsake them. Now there's some discussion on this is when they've chosen bad ways. There are friends I have who would say you reject them and don't let them to ever come back. I personally think that we have to remain like God remains, loving and caring. Yes.
Who's the fellow that wrote that? Yeah, I think it's Ross Campbell that wrote How to Love Your Teenager.
Right.
And he mentions the issue of the filling out your emotional tank, and oftentimes that's a phone call. It's just I want to dump the truck, and they don't need any feedback or input.
Right. Yeah, you just listen.
We thought we would respond, well, if you hadn't done this, you should have done that. And that's not the emotional refuge they need at the moment.
That's right. They just need someone to listen. And they don't have many people because, see, they can listen, give, dump it on you, knowing that you're going to love them regardless. It's tough on you. Now, there are problems not under the control of this young adult. For instance, things like the death of a spouse or a child, accidents in the automobile or in a home, or serious illness or health problems, career failures, financial collapse that really was not their own doing, or emotional or psychological problems. And many of you know Doug Sparks. His daughter and son-in-law were killed in a tragic auto accident a little over a year ago. And then their little grandson was left very badly injured and so forth. Well, they have gone, see, that wasn't under the control of these other folks. So what can you do now when they really need help? One is begin to marshal prayer on their behalf. They may be so stunned that they can't do that. Second is help them by physically or financially, whatever it is, do whatever you can. Move in, care for their children, do whatever you can to lift their load. This is where parents can go into high gear, really go into high gear. Help them find good care, medical care, psychological care. You've got a network that they don't have. So you know people. They don't even know where to turn. They don't know what doctor to call. They live in Pittsburgh and you live in Denver. But yet you've got networks of friends and you can probably find out something that they can't. You know, if something happened like that, I'd call Jim Maxwell or someone like that. And I'd say, Jim, my kids in Pittsburgh are having a problem. Do you know any doctor back there? And we'd start networking. We'd start trying to figure it out. You'd call friends. So do it. Give the financial help and counsel, if you can give it, the help that is. And help them think through their situation. Because at times like that, it's so difficult for them to think things through. It was like last night, our daughter in Seattle called, and I didn't talk to her, but Mary did, and they found their insurance for the child they're going to have covers just a minuscule amount, and they're almost being forced into a situation of using a midwife, and it's very, very difficult for them to think this through. And so we wrestle with, how much do we rescue? How much do we help? What do we do in this situation when they just simply don't have the resources? He's a youth pastor, and his salary is not exactly spectacular. So we have to think these things through. But for yourself, let me give a concluding comment for yourself. Regardless of the circumstances, remember that your fellowship with God is going to be the key help for your kids. And you've got to deepen. The second thing is guard your health. If you run down, then you can't help. And the third thing is have a group of friends to pray and share with. I'd like to close our time, and we had hoped to have questions at the end, but we had them in the middle, so that's good. My second daughter, Karen, wrote me a poem on Father's Day of 1984. She said this, she called it The Prodigal Daughter. She said, "Do you remember playing horse when Mom was at school, teaching me to skate and ride a bike? My first riding lesson on a horse named Clown, laughter and fun with cadets and friends? Do you remember when all that began to fade, when you were faced with a frustrated, strong-willed teenager? Year after year, you stood by and watched as turmoil and hatred emerged, yet you could not help. With each attempt to reach me, I drew further within my shell. I moved to the coast. The path I chose worsened. Church, core group, God's creation company, all a charade. I played the part well. Math, frustration, anger, arguments, tears. You saw the pain but could not help. Your wisdom sent me on a journey to Bible school. The charade continued. Frustration grew. Parents' weekend, I was alone. The pent-up pain and anger erupted and I broke. As always, you were there. Could you see the healing begin, the anger fading away? My second year away, I'm homesick. I look to you for help and guidance. You are always there to back me up, to encourage, to advise, and to listen. Remember the times you were there, caring, loving, hurting, praying, always there. I remember the many times I wanted to give you a hug and to say that I loved you and cared. The many tears I shed over the arguments we'd had. I'm sorry for the pain I caused, for the many times I turned my back and said I did not care. I did care. I do care. I praise God for giving me a very special dad, a man I look up to for many things, and especially for letting me go so I could find my own way home. Well, Dad, I'm home now." Pardon me. Time ago, but still there. "Well, Dad, I'm home now. My wandering is over. May I come home? Are you wondering what this is for? I wanted to say in a special way, thank you for patiently praying and waiting for me to learn. Most of all, this is to say I love you and I'm proud to be your daughter. Now I'm praying that we can be friends as God intended us to be. Thank you, Dad, for being you. I love you very much." Oh, I cannot quite do it. I'm not going to use that poem anymore.
That's the end.